I don't know whether I should or not. I have debated it all afternoon. In fact, I have arrived right now at this point, and the debate is still raging within me since it is Friday night. And Friday night is a night of general good cheer. Friday night is a night of universal cheering. It is also a night of incipient disaster. And I would be willing to venture. In fact, I would put good, hard coin of the realm on it that at least 50 guys who are listening to the program tonight, maybe even at this moment, unsuspectingly, are on the very verge of a disaster from which they will never recover. Now, they don't know it. All they know is they're heading for the drive-in. But you're heading for more than that, Dad. And I could just hear my voice is coming out of this flocked loudspeaker on the flocked control board, the flocked instrument panel of a 1947 Mercury. You know what they do, that flocking stuff? You know when they spray that? You know what flocking is? It's that sort of, it looks like phony suede. That's flocking, you know. It's flocking. Flocking. And most guys who do that have their dashboard flocked in a kind of, an odd sort of fuchsia color. And usually on the cover of the, this is the, of course, this is dynamic slobism, on the cover of their glove compartment, they usually have one of these decals of a naked girl. You know, the kind of, well, she isn't really naked. She's wearing these little ribbon there, a red, white, and blue ribbon maybe, and she's wearing a red, white, and blue hi-hat, and underneath it says U.S. of A. Then on top of his, you know, that kind of control board, that sort of dashboard, you've seen it, Ed, and he's got bad shackles, and his shock absorbers went like the third owner they went, and he's the seventh owner, this guy. And you can hear those shocks banging and clanking as you go. He's got plastic seat covers, and he's got two religious statues up on top of that little swinging radio dial there, which all day long gets rock and roll. I don't know. It's an interesting combination, those plastic statues and the rock and roll coming out, and the time being bellowed every 30 seconds. I don't know, there's a whole surrealistic concept here. But I can see this guy driving along in his Mercury, and he's got a spinner, you know, a looks like a ruby spinner with a death's head carved in it on his steering wheel, which is also flocked. And he's driving along. You hear the old exhaust pounding there through those Hollywood pipes. And he's driving along, and Shepard comes right out of the loudspeaker and says, "Dad, you're heading for more than the drive-in." And you see a little flicker in his cretinous mind. Says, "Yeah, man." Well, he doesn't quite know what I'm saying here, actually, though, man. So you better be, you're heading for more than the drive-in. Yeah. And there's a whole concept here, and I've been debating whether or not to tell you the story or tell myself the story. It's taken, well, it really does. It takes us a long time, sometimes as long as a whole lifetime, to ever actually talk about a truly traumatic experience. Sometimes we never talk about them. Our mind is like a tape recorder in some ways. It'll record just perfectly. It goes on and on. The memory, you know, it records on down the line. Everything you see, everything you do, everything you hear, it's recording on that old gigantic tape of life. And it's recording. And it's plastic, of course. And it's recording it. But there's something about that tape recorder is that it seems to have a kind of self-operating, self-editing eraser. It erases a lot of stuff that it doesn't want to record. You know, it just sort of clips it out as it goes along. And then maybe about 9 years later, suddenly all that tape that you have erased out or have clipped out or have edited out, you find kicking around down there under the desk, and the next thing you know, it's playing out through the loudspeaker. Well, now, I don't know whether, shall I tell you or shall I not? Since, as I say, it's a great night. I can sing, it's Friday night. My cold is on the wane. I feel like I'm ready for business here. I have the urge to sing seven choruses of the Sheik of Araby. I'd like to do a little tent creeping here. I could sing Ragtime Cowboy Joe. I could do some head thumping. Or, on the other hand, I could tell you the story of the great sinking sensation. The great sinking sensation, that's capitalized, which we all have had at one time or another in our life, but some guys have had it more than others because of the area in which the sinking took place. Now, I don't know whether to tell you that or not. I suggest you... No, don't just say, yeah, tell it. It could be very depressing. Could be very depressing. And I don't want to depress anybody who's heading for a big thing at the drive-in. In addition to the pizza and the Chinese egg rolls and all the stuff he's going to get at the drive-in, he could be heading for all kinds of things. I don't want to throw a wet blanket over that. All right. Before we go into this, I have to preface it by telling you that if you're a lady and if you're a kid, you know who you are. I don't have to tell you if you're among the women and children. If you are, you better get back to that soft, easy station down the line there where they just play soft, easy music and come out with soft, easy newscasts every half hour, little tiny, itsy-bitsy ones. There's one station on the dial now that bills itself as the station of instant weather. You kind of like that one. Yes, they've got instant weather down there, and here's a typical instant weather report. It's hot, and then they go on. You know, it's instant weather. Well, I was up in Maine, or was it New Hampshire or Vermont? That state way up there in the north there, a couple of days ago, and I'm driving along a road, a country road, and there is a station up there. Its call letters is WJOY. And naturally, you know what kind of radio they have. I don't have to tell you that. And here's this. And I says, I got to hear that station. So I turn down the radio in the car, and sure enough, the announcer comes on, and he says, it's WJOY. It's coming to you. This is Joy Radio, coming to you from the heart of Joyland. Think of it. The heart of Joyland. And there was a gentle, cold, clammy, dead rain falling out there, and you could see a couple of sad, gray-looking natives wandering around out there in the gray, falling landscape, and you could hear the occasional moan of someone who knew they weren't ever going to get out, and you could see those gray faces sniffing and snuffling through that twilight, and all the while, all around them, was Joy Radio booming out from the heart of Joyland. Oh, God. Where are we going? You wonder which way it's going to happen. But on the subject, I might as well tell you about this. You know, the people who, I'd say most people live lives that are fairly protected, I mean in this sense, that very few of you have ever been lacerated in print. Literally lacerated in print. You know the kind of thing which is, Ed Zajac was rotten last night. Zajac once again showed his basic immaturity as he groped towards doing what he knows he can never do. Zajac bores this aisle sitter. Zajac is a bum. And now let's get on to other subjects. Well, very few people have ever actually been excoriated. You know, almost all of our lives we spend trying to gain approval in one way or another from other people. Really, you know? And most people somehow have been, if not approval, at least you hope that nobody notices, you know? And generally speaking, most guys can get away with it. Guys with strong unions, guys with anonymous-type jobs, all kinds of things, guys that are on the schedule, you know, they've been able to escape this. And once in a while, of course, a little hell breaks out at home. Somebody, oh, yeah, did it again! And that's about all. It's all private, a lot of yelling in the bathroom, and once in a while a little yelling in the kitchen, and even occasionally a little yelling out on the front porch. But rarely is it public yelling. Rarely does the man know that he has been humiliated before the entire population, and even this, Ed, it goes further, humiliated before absolute strangers. And not only that, but you find that they are enjoying your humiliation, that they are agreeing you are a bum. And a slob and an idiot. Well, now I don't know. I just have often wondered how it must feel to live in the world of the people who are protected. You know, of course, that anybody who goes on any kind of a public medium lays himself open for this. Tomorrow morning, without even telling me, somebody in the public print could write a column that starts out with that jackass Shepherd. Again last night laid another fantastic ostrich egg. Shepherd, who thinks he's funny, that blah, 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 the clown, idiot, bum, boob, I think he should get fired. And now let's get on to other pleasanter subjects. Last night, Ann Margaret, you know, that kind of thing. Well, I mean, I don't know. Do you know? I'm going to tell you how far it goes. Do you know that one time, and I will not. Of course, the critic in this world is getting completely too big for his pants. Oh yes, many a critic feels that he is not only the custodian of the theater, he is in some way, in some shape, the defender of it and the creator of it. This gets a little wild. And you have no idea. Did I ever tell you about what I thought was the most unethical, the most unprofessional thing that's ever happened to me in this idiotic profession? Do you know that one time, not too long ago, a critic here in New York wrote a letter to the boss here at WOR. Just a letter, a personal letter. Not a column or anything, just a personal letter. It says, Dear Mr. Leader, how come you've got that bum on every night? I don't want to hear that bum. The other night I was trying to do some writing, and I wanted some music, and then you got this bum. Who cares about this bum? Why don't you get this bum out of here, please, so I can do some typing? Now, I don't know how many of you have ever had, you know, somebody write to... Yeah, can you imagine that? But I won't even tell you the name of this critic. Every time I hear this critic's name, the hackles go up. And incidentally, it is not a man. I'm not saying it's a woman. I will tell you, it is not a man. I feel the hackles go up. And I want to describe to you, if I may, if since it's only Friday night. Should I tell the story of the gigantic sinking sensation of the time? Well, should I? Speaking of sinking sensations, this is WOR AM and FM New York. We better get all the commercials right out of the way, right away, shall we here? We got with us tonight Mandarin House. And we follow that Buick. Did you listen carefully to that Buick spot? Really listen to it? You know, one day sociologists are really going to have a field day with that kind of, although I don't think so. You know, it's an interesting thing to see that gradually, it is becoming almost impossible to really remove yourself from the civilization we live in. It's, you just accept it, you know? Just getting, of course, we like to think that 1,000 years from now, people are going to write about how wild it was now. But we have no idea how wild it could be then. In fact, I have a prediction to make here, if it makes any difference to you, that I suspect within just a year or two, we will look back on 1963 as those wonderful, dear, dead, naive, halcyon days when we were talking about little things like Castro and little things like the H-bomb. In fact, I was reading a news magazine, which was published in it was a Time magazine, actually. And it was back in the mid-1950s. I just picked up a copy. It was laying there, and I started to read it. It was 1956 or something. And reading the problems that were facing the people in 56, it was greasy kid stuff. Really. And in 1963, of course, it's getting wilder. And who knows what it'll be in 67. Yes, it's got to be. We have a couple more of these. We have American Heritage with us, and if you have never popped for American Heritage, it's no wonder. It costs $3.95 a copy. But it is a fine magazine. It's a magazine really in hardcovers, and it's the kind of thing that is designed to be kept and is beautiful reproduction, and I enjoy it. I've been taking American Heritage ever since I got it as a gift a long time ago when it was not a hardcover magazine, and I don't think I've missed a copy since. And if you don't know about it, send a buck to American Heritage in care of me, Gaunt Rockwell, WOR, New York, New York. That's American Heritage in care of me, Gene Autry, WOR, New York, New York. Send $1 in care of American Heritage in care of me, Victor Jory, WOR, New York, New York. Send $1 in care of... Excuse me, do we run out of time?
Hello, I'm Tony Marvin.
Fine. I'm glad to see you, Tony. I suspect some of these guys' whole lives are transcribed. While we're on the subject of transcription, one more thing. Oh, we have the opera tomorrow. Boris Godunov is on tomorrow. That's a gasser. I don't know how we can parallel Boris Godunov with that fashion show, but there is a connection, I'm sure. Now, let's get back to this thing. Somebody wrote me a letter that gave me an idea, and I don't often talk about mail on the show. But somebody wrote me a letter here a couple of days ago. And they said, Shepard, You're in the theater and in showbiz and all that stuff, and you talk a lot about baseball, and you talk a lot about stuff you did when you were a kid, and you talk about when you were in the Army, and you hardly ever talk about wild things that happened to you when you were in show, you know, when you're doing a show or something of that nature. Well, and I thought about, you know, I thought, well, you know, that's true, and maybe the reason this is true is because so many of the things that happened to you are too traumatic to really talk about. They're too personal. And then you have to wait a while until after they stop hurting, or till the slivers are out, or to where your socks stay up again, or where you stop sweating, and then you can start talking about it, you know? Well, Ed, I'm going to tell you something about this. I'm going to tell you one of the worst feelings that I have ever had in my entire life, regardless of anything I have ever done. Now, I'm going to preface it by saying most of you, I presume, have never been on the stage. If you have, maybe it's an amateur theatrics somewhere. Maybe it's the little theater group of Groton, Connecticut. I'm talking about the stage, boy. I'm talking about where the unions are and where the guys come out with gigantic shotguns to shoot you down when you go up there on that stage. In short, the professional theater. Now, most people that you hear talking about the professional theater are actors. Now, by actors, I mean they're actors. Now, that's a very different thing from what I'm about to talk about. An actor, to an actor, life is always beautiful. The play is always wonderful. You've heard them endlessly being interviewed on the air. They talk about the wonderful people they work with, the wonderful directors they've worked with. And, of course, I don't have to tell you, it is a gigantic tank of hogwash. I do not have to tell you that because I assume you know that. Before we go, I have to tell you that almost everybody who works in a play with anybody else has developed before the play opens either a terrific antipathy towards large numbers of the other people in the cast, or is clinging to somebody because it's the only other one who's been getting the business from the director. And they'll align themselves just like traditional alignments in politics. In short, we were a political ally of Russia. Not political, but a war ally of Russia during World War II. Only because there was somebody bigger, or at least somebody making more noise and blowing a lot of people up, that we had to get together to fight. Well, you will find most theatrical alliances are roughly of that order. And so, two guys will be sitting in the theater, in the dark of the theater, and both of them will suddenly break into tears and recognize that each one of them recognizes that not only is the director a complete idiot, but he's got it out for both of them. Well, then, of course, then you have solid, thick friends until the next play. Then, of course, all the alliances change all the way up and down the line. So this is not what we're talking about. Now, most actors will never tell you, nor will you ever hear them discuss the business of the fantastic sinking sensation. Now, I don't know how to express it except to say it. That's what it could be called. Primarily because most of them hide behind the play. Now, if they walk out on the stage, of course, they're also lucky because our theater and our theatrical criticism is based on that. That if it's a lousy night, They never say the actors were terrible. They always say Myrtle, who we know is radiant and is a beautiful, loved creature and one of the beloved people in the theater, was miscast. They would never say Myrtle really laid an egg last night. Absolutely was rotten. She didn't know her lines. She was terrible in the part. And obviously she didn't know anything from anything else when it came to delineating this character. I could have told you what they should have said. They never do that, you see. So actors are lucky. Usually they'll say, oh boy, did Chris Cleverly write a rotten turkey? It's too bad that Geraldine Page don't get better material. See, again, they exonerate her. Well, this is a very good thing because actors know it, you know. They hardly ever get really blasted. And so in the end, a blast in the theater amounts to a slight, if you just get lukewarm praise, that's called a terrible blast. Oh, yes, that's a terrible blast, because actors are used to always either getting ecstatic raves or nice notices. They will say, Charlie Brown was very nice in his big scene in the second act. Well, so all Charlie had was 3.5 minutes on the stage. He damn well better be nice. Charlie's only been in the theater now for 15 years. He should know how to handle it. But somehow we're always vaguely surprised that Charlie was good in the second act in that 3-minute bit. However, writers are another story. They shoot them down unless they get to be beloved characters. Then they don't get shot down anymore. There is always a vague disappointment. Now, if, say, for example, for 9 plays straight, Tennessee Williams has been groping toward a new plateau. Well, what they just said is that he wrote about 5 straight bad plays. They figure he's aiming towards something that hasn't hit it yet, you know? But they never quite will say that. So it's a very complicated thing, this business of theatrical protocol. But nobody will ever talk much about what happens when you are involved in and part and parcel of something that is a total fiasco, a disaster. The gigantic sinking sensation from knowing there's no place to hide. Now, most of you guys have always got some place to hide. You really do, you know. I know. I just look around me and I see all the jobs that are around me. And I know that most guys, in one way or another, have built-in safeguards. Our society and the whole world of automation is based on that. It's based on security and love and one thing and another. And even to this day, now, in fact, a very interesting thing, I'm going to give you an idea of that. A professor, who is a listener, sent me a copy of a letter that was written to him by the Committee on Ethics of the university where he teaches. It seems that this student was caught cheating in this professor's classes. He had been cribbing notes, and they had an exam, and he had all kinds of notes written on his cuff and on the inside of his glasses and on the inside of his ear and on his back teeth and everything else. Well, they caught this guy, see. Well, now, in the old days, if you were way out on a limb like that, what happened? Pow, you get blasted. They just fire you. That's it. Or they raise Cain with you of one kind or another, really. Well, here was where the letter read. I, of course, will change all the names, and I will paraphrase. Dear Charles, you don't know me, but I'm the professor here in charge of ethical activities on the part of the students. And we understand from Professor Watanabe that there was a little misunderstanding and certainly a little unpleasantness about an alleged incident of cheating in his exam there in that class. Well, we realize that work is very tough on you, and we realize that you are living in a world that is difficult sometimes for you to comprehend. Why don't you just come in and talk to us and be friendly with us about this problem? We know that we can work it out and straighten it out. And as far as what those terrible things that Professor Watanabe said, I'm sure that today, if he had a chance to say it all over again, he wouldn't be as harsh. Now just come in, please, and give us a chance, will you, Charlie? Sign very much yours, your servant obediently, Professor L.D. Smitherspoon, Ethics Committee. That's a fact. Well, now, you see, built-in safeguards. In other words, it is impossible to get blasted in our world, no matter what you do. Seriously, a guy gets picked up for heroin or pot, immediately 14 newspapers downtown start defending him. You just cannot get into trouble, really. And so it's all built in. So most of you haven't had the kind of job where you really can get blasted. Well, one time I was involved in a show, so now we're going to get down to the basic problem here. And we rehearsed and we rehearsed and we rehearsed. Have you ever read the kind of review where they say, we wonder how this fantastic performer got involved in such a terrible turkey? How did all these people get together? Why did they do it? Well, I'll tell you what happens. Now, this is something that is rarely talked about. Here's what happens. Usually, when you get together, the idea is good and sound. The material is good. It's what happens between the time you talk about it and the time you actually do it before the audience that everything falls apart. And by then, it's usually too late. It's like a guy decides that he's going to make them all feel sorry by jumping off the 47th story of the Empire State Building. Well, now, by the time he gets down to the 23rd floor, it's too late, you know. Now, you've got them all going. It's a good idea. You want them to feel sorry. But, you know, well, there's sometimes you just can't back out. You know, you just feel it all. The ground is creaking under you. Quicksand is up to your knees. Shot and shell is booming around you. And you know you're not going to escape. Well, let me tell you one of the wildest, the most discouraging, unbelievable sinking sensations I have ever had in my life. They had in this show, this was a review. They had in this show a sketch. Now, you know what sketches are. A sketch is a little play. Now, there's a specific way to play sketches. The review player, the person who has done reviews, knows how to get laughs out of stuff that isn't even funny. And, in fact, that's what's called being a bright young person. And all reviews are about bright young people. It doesn't make any difference. Some people have been bright young people for 35 years playing in the same reviews. It doesn't matter. They're all bright and they're all young. And they're all review performers. Well, we had this sketch. And we worked on it, worked on it, worked on it. And the sketch was so funny when we first read it that it was impossible to read it with a straight face. You know, it was the kind of thing, you just sit there and you think you're going to do something very embarrassing. And you have to raise your hand and ask to be allowed to leave the room. Because the sketch is so funny. And everybody's boffing it up and yelling and falling on the floor. And the dog is laughing. The whole thing, you know, everything is going on. We're reading this thing. So we go into rehearsal, and we work. We are in a rehearsal hall. Now, again, most of you have probably never had any experience with a professional theater in rehearsal hall. It is not the way Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney would have you believe on the late, late night movie, you know, where all of a sudden, hey, kids, let's have a show. Okay, all right, you play the piano, Mickey. And all the little fat girls start doing this wild choreography, and it's no problem at all. Well, it doesn't work like that. We have been working now on this show, Ed, like 45 straight hours a day for like 250 days straight. And raising dust in the rehearsal hall, sweating, mad. Everybody hates everybody else. And by this time, you don't even know whether anything's funny or not. You're just doing it, you know, and you're doing it. You're working on getting every little detail. Well, now, it seems that after a certain point when you're working on something, you can no longer see it. You really can't. Writers know what I'm talking about. Painters know what I'm talking about, and certainly actors do. Well, we worked on this sketch, and little did we realize what we were doing to it. We worked on it and worked on it and worked on it until one day we had the scenery. We had the rehearsal, and it was great, you know, to walk out there on the scenery. You got the funny hat on and everything else, and all the other actors are around there. You're doing the thing, and everybody is sitting out there who are your friends, you know. We're not performing it. The other actors who are going to be in other things, and they're just yakking it up. Oh, that was wonderful. Just great. Boy, oh, boy, Socceroni. Yowee. And so you feel terrific, you see. Well, the big night finally arrives, but it doesn't arrive the way you think it's going to arrive. We travel all the way up to the frozen north, and we are now on the stage of the biggest theater in North America. There's a place called the O'Keefe Center, and this theater is, well, it makes the Lincoln Center over here kind of look like the Aeolian Brotherhood Hall on East 86th Street. I'm serious. This is unbelievable, this place. And it stretches up and up and up and back and back and back and out and out and out. It's kind of like being in Yankee Stadium. And it's beautiful. You know, it's just all dark, muted brown colors, and they have this tremendous just the best dressing rooms. It's all beautiful and everything. So you come in, you know, and you're just feeling great. All the costumes are there, and they bring it all up, and there's excitement, and people are buying tickets, and, you know, you sort of get picked up in this whole thing. You really feel great. Your eyes are shining, and your tail is bushy. Well, the big night happens. I am standing back of the curtain, and I can hear the overture being played. Before this big old, and it's for real, you know? And it's, and this place is so big, it sounds like the orchestra is playing somewhere in the next block, so far away from you it is. And the stage, believe me, the stage is like like a football field. It's so big. Oh, just tremendous. And up to this point, of course, we have been playing in our little rehearsal hall. But now we're on this gigantic stage. It's like if you took all the Broadway theaters and put them all together end to end, you would have half of this stage. And it goes up so high that you can see snow up there. Some way up there near the top of the lights, you can see little snow. And once in a while, you see birds flying around way up there in the darkness and the flies. And here we are. We are the tiny little figures. And our little sets look like little bitty Tom Thumb things. And we can hear... And you hear this great crowd. And the overture ends, and it goes, and you hear a great roar, tremendous roar of applause, and the curtain, of course, is still down. Well, up goes the curtain, and you get this sense of, it's a hard thing to describe, the sense of a huge audience in a great auditorium, sitting on the edge of their seat, waiting for something. Well, you do. There is a feeling. There is a tremendous wave of something. It hits all of us, you see. We sort of stagger back, and you start the opening thing. Well, the opening stuff is very, in a sense, sort of innocuous. And I'm opening up, and I'm looking out. I see nothing but gigantic lights and all that. I can't see the guys I'm supposed to throw cues to or anything. Just lights all over the place. So I start doing a bit. It's coming out. Then there's a great big roar of applause. And then the first big musical number, and the dancers come out. And then we're supposed to do our first sketch. And I am frantically running down backstage, putting on the funny hat with the ears, you know, and I'm getting the big shoes on, and the other guy who's in it with me is getting his big rubber cigar, and the chick is putting on the big bustle and all this stuff, you know, we're working like mad and sweating, we're putting on and the dressers are hurrying, and we can hear the musical numbers going out there, we can see the dancers out there swinging away, and the lights are coming down. We're all excited, you see. Well, we tear into place, and the musical number, see, it was all in different areas, and the musical number goes, and boom, on comes the light, and I'm supposed to start out. You see, I'm going to open this big, this is the big opening sketch, like, you see, and it's going to be the first big bop. Well, Shepard walks with absolute confidence, because he knows it's funny. They've been doing it in the Aeolian Hall for years. His derby hat is on at a cocky angle. His rubber ears are flapping in the breeze. And he goes, have you taken care of all the whoopies? I wait for just a second. Absolute deadly silence from the audience. And this is the first line that had panicked everybody in rehearsal. Dead silence. So my compatriot, all of a sudden I see him. He looks across the stage at me, and I can see a sudden look of fear comes in his eyes. And he goes, quack, 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 quack. Gets me on the fanny with the cane. Dead silence. And then the chick goes, we're running real fast now. We're trying to do it. See, you begin to feel that if you do it faster, they won't notice. She goes, dead silence. And then I go, quack, 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 pow, with the water pistol. Now we are getting a reaction. It is a sullen muttering. An angry crowd. And my compatriot gets up off the chair with his big plastic salami, which he is about to hit the girl with. He walks over and he goes, pow, pow. And you hear way up on the balcony, a derisive laugh. Well, by now, all three of us up on the stage are sweat. You can see trails of sweat where we are walking, just little trails. And once in a while, you can see a puddle where somebody has stopped waiting for his cue. That sketch, I have to tell you, went on for over 13 straight hours. Now, I know they're going to tell you it only lasted 4.5 minutes. Don't you believe it. This is a problem in relativity. It was longer than Strange Interlude, which it certainly was. Well, all right. So you begin to figure, you know, well, maybe they're not getting it. And so you try to talk louder. Maybe they're not hearing it. So you go, wah, 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 quack, 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 wah, wah, wah. Well, about two-thirds of the way through, you begin to realize not only are they getting it, they are hearing it too good. And so one of your compatriots tries mumbling the line so they won't hear it and making it seem funny by flicking his glasses and throwing his cigar in the orchestra. So he goes, nothing, dead silence. Well, by this time, you are all swimming underwater. With the audience, you can feel them out there, 4,000 of them just looking up and just sitting there, 4,000, just looking up. And finally, you come to the big socko finish. You go, and so I sit. Dead silence. And then the orchestra goes, they have a stinger which goes on after the applause. It says right there on his music sheet, after laughter, come in with the wah, 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 wah. So you hear dead silence and then wah, wah, wah. Oh, boy. And then I see the frightened look on the face of the next guy who's waiting in the wings, who is now being led to the slaughter. He has seen what has happened to us. The curtain has gone down on us, and there we are, dripping blood, tattered, and he goes tearing out, and he goes, whoo, boop, 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 wah, 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 wah. Dead silence. Oh, oh, they're doing it to Freddy. Dead silence. Hour after hour it goes, not a laugh. Hour after hour, hour after hour. And then, I guess the worst part of it all is after you have had this terrible, terrible disaster, is then the next night, you got to go out and do it again. The next night, but by now, you know, it's like I don't have to tell you what happens after you've been burned once. A very different thing happens. So you stand off stage, you say, I've been working on it all day long. Now, I've got an idea now, see. So you've been doing push-ups and everything else. You need more energy. So you wait, and the cue comes up, and they go, wah, 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 wah. Boom! You go out on that stage like a shot. You go, wah, 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 pow! You hit him on the head with a salami. Derisive laughter, because by now, they have read the reviews. They know what to expect. So then he tries. Now, don't yawn yet, Ted. I never yawn when you're doing your stuff. So then he goes on with his. He sweats and he swears. Hour after hour, you play it again. And then I think probably even worse than going on the second night is having to come back after you've laid an egg in the first act. To come back completely unadorned, alone, and try to do a solo. And all they can do is remember you with great anger from that thing that you did earlier, that thing that they have hoped that they would forget, and here you are out again with the ears on, with the funny hat, and you look out at the audience, you say, well, how is it? How are you going? What happened? Dead silence. Then you go, dead silence. Then you hear the producer laugh.